The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Teachings of Buddhism, relatively quickly they come across a teaching which sometimes is perplexing, and that's the teaching called teaching of what's sometimes known as no self, maybe more appropriately called not self. Especially when it's said, when there's a teaching about no self, that raises a lot of questions in people's minds. You know, people assume that what Buddha taught was that there is no self, and since they're standing here, you know, if there's no self, who am I? What's going on here? I mean, that's ridiculous teaching. What do you mean, no self? More properly, it's called not self-teaching. It's considered to be one of the core teachings of Buddhism. And it's a teaching which, if you look and read the early texts, the early teachings of the Buddha, it probably qualifies as a more advanced teaching. And in more advanced, not so much you have to spend years studying Buddhism, but advanced in the sense that it's something that becomes relevant as an understanding, as an insight, as a realization when one's practice is quite strong, when the mind's ability to be mindful, concentrated, equanimous is quite strong. And it's you need to have a strong inner development of strengths, of capacity, to be able to really see into this aspect of what's called not-self. And some of those qualities of character that need to be built up and created so we see for ourselves the not-self understanding, the not-self thing, are what a modern psychologist, many of them would call the qualities that make a strong self. You know, you might be going to a therapist, we need to build up your sense of self. It's important to have a strong sense of self. And Buddhism doesn't use that language so much, but a lot of the qualities that a therapist maybe wants to build up for you are the very things that in Buddhism you want to build up as well, so that you can have insight into not-self. It doesn't mean that the Buddha never used the word self in his discussion, and there's a... to a group of people who had never heard about his teachings, he ran into them, and he was meditating peacefully in a park, and they were a bunch of aristocrats who had gone out for young aristocrats who went out to an outing in the park, a picnic or something, and with the husbands and wives. But one of the men wasn't married, I guess, and so had brought with him a courtesan. And so they all frolicked and did what they do in parks, young people, I don't know. They had a picnic, and anyway, they fell asleep. They took a nap. Everyone but the courtesan. And when they woke up, the courtesan was gone, and so was all their jewelry. So they went looking for her, and instead of finding her, they found the Buddha sitting under a tree, and they asked the Buddha, "Have you seen a woman?" And the Buddha's reply, you know, thinking maybe he'd walk by, right? And he knew. And the Buddha's reply was, "What would you rather find, a woman or yourself?" And that got their attention enough that they sat down to hear what he had to say. And so he proceeded to teach them. And so, you know, you could fill in that blank. What would you rather find, X or yourself? And I think the assumption is we want to find ourselves. In my early years of practice, and when I was a student at San Francisco Zen Center, some of the more senior teachers there would sometimes say that that was one of the first tasks of the... When people first came to Zen Center, the first couple of years of doing kind of, you know, more serious Buddhist practice, especially because back then a lot of the people who came into practice were quite young. Most of the people were probably in their 20s, and I was 21. The task was to find themselves, was to build themselves up, to understand who they were. And what they said, by the way, what my teacher said was some people, once they had found themselves, kind of got a sense of who they were, what their values were, what they wanted to do with their life, who they were in relationship to other people, how to kind of function in a responsible, honest, ethical way in the world. A variety of things that they learned that we can call finding yourself. They would then leave Zen Center and go and start their life, do what they had to do. And the way in which they felt disintegrated, the way they felt kind of their suffering, had a lot to do with this whole notion of self and needing to find themselves, build it up, get established that way. And then once that was there, there was no strong momentum to keep practicing. Those who kept practicing beyond that, these teachers at Zen Center would say, that only then would they start practicing Buddhism. And whatever they were practicing before was valuable, but it wasn't Buddhism, because it's not just about finding yourself. But that's an important thing. The other thing the Buddha said about self, which is I think kind of inspiring, is that near the end of his life, he was about to die. When teachers die, sometimes they give their best teachings, or the most important teachings they have to give. And so he was close to his death, and he said, "Make an island unto yourself. Make yourself an island. Make yourself a refuge. Have no other refuge. Make the Dharma your refuge. Have no other refuge." So there in that little statement, he said, make the self your refuge. And the idea that you yourself would be a refuge, a source of security, a stability, a place of protection, that you would be, the refuge in Buddhism is one of the most inspiring things you can do. Usually it's called the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. But near the end of his life, what he saw as his refuge was not in himself, not in the Dharma, not in the Sangha, but rather you find it in yourself. Like what's most sacred, what's most important, what the resources you have for being free is found in yourself. And I see that as being, elevating the status of every individual being or offering a tremendous amount of respect to our individual values and our importance to that we can find in ourselves a refuge, a support, a path to freedom. So as practitioners deepen their practice in the time of the Buddha, at some point the Buddha would see that they were ready to understand or to realize, to see this teachings on not self. And before I tell you what that is, I want to kind of get to it slowly a little bit. Otherwise it's confusing maybe. Part of the confusion when people hear this teaching is they very quickly, many people will interpret it philosophically. And in Buddhism, you're probably more appropriate to interpret, understand, or understand it psychologically. And what I mean by that is that philosophically, we have these philosophical ideas about what the self is, what the soul is, what the nature of the universe is. Answering these big questions, the existential philosophical answers to the existential issue of who we are, what we are. And, there's no end to those kinds of questions. There's no end to discussions. We could stay up in the dorms late at night in college, having great debates about what the self is, the purpose of the self, purpose of life, and all that. And the Buddha wasn't a philosopher. He was more of a, if anything, he was a therapist. He was a doctor. He was a psychologist who was bringing a certain kind of therapy, the therapy to end suffering. So he's interested in it psychologically. And also by looking at it psychologically, when we look at the mind, what the mind does. What's the activity of the mind? How do we understand that? And there are activities in our mind that we want to see and understand and become free of. because certain activities of the mind brings us suffering. So one of the things he talked about was three different areas of selfing that people suffer, three different ways in which people relate to the self that is clearly a psychological form of suffering, three psychological attitudes. There was an attitude of craving, an attitude of conceit, and an attitude of views. So craving has to do with the idea that something is mine. Then you can fill it in. My car, my house, my clothes, my... You know, one of the very interesting things is to... Maybe some of you, if you found a cushion or a chair to sit in here during your visit here this evening, and you just pulled the cushion off the shelf and used it, or you just found a chair that was empty and you sat down. And then in the middle of the talk or middle of the sitting, you have to go to the bathroom. So you get up and you go to the bathroom and you come back to take your place, right, where you were. But someone else is sitting there now. My seat. That was my seat. That was my cushion. How could that person take it on my seat? Half an hour earlier, it was not your... You had no thought about it being your seat. And if they hadn't sat in your seat, you would have gone away and come back the next time you came to IMC, and you wouldn't even recognize it. You don't even know idea what seat chair you were sitting. We move them around. They have yoga. They move the chairs around. My seat. So the idea that something is mine can get us really riled up. And it can be as simple as coming back, that's my seat. What are you doing? So what are some of the things we take as mine? My views, my philosophy, my good looks, thank you. All these things, but this is mine. And we protect it, we try to acquire it. And part of the, not always, I mean, you can innocently say something is mine, but one way that we suffer around this selfing, this the self, is that is the grip of craving. We have a craving, I want this to be mine. And so we grip onto that, and so if we grip hard enough, our knuckles go white. If we grip hard enough, we suffer a lot. So that's one psychological activity that brings suffering. We grasp tight, we grip on tight, this is mine. The other way is the grip of conceit. And this is not that something is mine, but rather it fills in the statement, I am X. So I'm great. I'm handsome, thank you. I am, I'm a very good... whatever. You can fill it in. I'm smart. I'm better than other people. I'm worse than other people. I'm stupid. I am. And there are statements you can say that's okay. I mean, for example, generally, it's reasonable to say that I'm a man. It's reasonable, I think. You don't really know. You should never assume these things too easily. There's all these different ways of being that are wonderful. But generally you can say I'm a man. It's okay. I go to the men's bathroom after all. But I could go, I'm a man. Or I can growl at the end, right? And it has a whole different feeling, the grip of conceit. I'm special. I'm a man. I'm a man's man. it gets kind of fun, right? Or sad or something. But the women shouldn't laugh too much because Occasionally women do something similar. So, you know, this I am something, you know, and there's a lot of suffering around that, the grip of conceit. I'm special. And, you know, what's interesting about Buddhism is that there's tremendous conceit in seeing that you're worse than other people, that you're less than. It's another way of grip, of holding on to some idea, I am this way. So that's a psychological activity. It can be done innocently. You can say, I'm something. I'm a resident of Redwood City. Great. And, you know, that's a fine. But a salesman asked me today, it was kind of strange, I thought. He said, well, where do you want to register this thing that you want to buy? I said, what do you mean, where do I want to register it? Because if you, in Santa Clara or San Mateo County, because the property tax is different. Oh, I am from San Mateo County. I'm a resident of San Mateo County, thank you. Suddenly who I am is very important. You know, and you can kind of fill in and understand, I think, that there can be a lot of suffering around conceit. People get very shy, they get very arrogant, they get, sometimes they freeze, sometimes they oppress other people because of it. The grip of conceit, psychological condition that can cause a lot of suffering. If you want to become free of suffering, that's one of the things to consider, is the degree to which you have conceit around self that way. The third form of psychological condition that the Buddha wanted to address is the conceit of views. And in his teaching, that probably translates into the conceit of kind of metaphysical philosophy about the self. For our kind of convention, for our kind of life here in the West, I think it also works very well for the attachment to stories we have about who we are, stories about how we fit into the world. And but we can be attached to views, we can be attached to philosophical positions. This is who I really am. And you can have, you know, in the college dorms again, you know, late at night, there can be very intense these conversations about what, you know, what's really true. And is there a soul? Is there not a soul? Will I live after I die? Will I not live after I die? And people can be very invested in their opinions and views, and they can fight, they get angry, they can hold on, there can be the grip of views that we have. Again, it doesn't mean that that views are wrong in and of themselves. There can be views, there can be philosophies that are okay to have, perhaps. However, it's the grip that causes suffering, because your knuckles get white, your hands will get numb. So the Buddha was interested in psychology of suffering, and so the suffering, the source of the suffering, has to do with some activity in our brain, our mind, that we do, that I'm calling now the grip. We grip on, we get attached to these things. So these three areas. So if we rush into discussing the philosophy of it, then we miss the point of what the Buddha was about. The philosophy of what the self really is not really interesting for the Buddha. And in fact, he never really answered the question, is there or is there not a self? He was asked that point blank once, and rather than answering, he remained silent. And so even a lot of Buddhist texts will say the Buddha taught there is no self. He never said that. He never said there was no self. And when he was asked it pointedly, he refused to answer either there is a self or there is no self. And he said at one point that if you posit that there is no self, then you'll get caught up in a quagmire of views, quicksand of views. You never get out. So he seemed to not want to go that route, say there is no self. But this is what he said. And this is why, in order to have some strong inner stability, a lot of equanimity, a lot of mindfulness, a lot of strength of concentration, a lot of maybe a lot of compassion, a lot of goodness, you sit there, your refuge unto yourself, your present. You're equanimous, you're at ease, you're balanced. So you can really kind of see what's going on, be present for what's going on. and see it in a deep way. And then, and maybe to give a sense to you of the context for the kind of insight, the kind of seeing or presence that helps to have this insight, is when the Buddha's son was about 20 years old. The Buddha, by that time, his son was also a monk and had been practicing for many years. And the Buddha saw that his son, his name was Rahula, was ripe, that he was fairly mature in his meditation practice, in his own practice, his spiritual development. And he said, come with me. And he took him deep in the woods to a place that had this beautiful sal trees. My understanding is they're kind of like the redwood trees of northern India, so quite majestic, large trees. And he went and into a grove. And you can imagine this grove, this beautiful grove. I imagine a beautiful grove deep in the woods, these majestic trees like the redwood trees. And, you know, beautiful, maybe inspiring natural setting. Wonderful place for a father to go take his son, to have a father and son chat. It's like, you know, you go up, there's beautiful redwood groves in California. And in the context of sitting there in these majestic groves, how do you see yourself? You see yourself in a very different way than when you go to IKEA. Probably, you know, your concerns, how you think about yourself, and what you want to try to do, and what's important is very different up in the redwoods in the forest than in IKEA. And you know, in IKEA, maybe you don't have much resilience for, you know, for all kinds of things and what people say to you and who are you really. You know, someone comes up to you in IKEA and says, "Who are you really?" Get away. But you're sitting in the redwood groves and someone says, "Who are you?" And you kind of look around in the trees and the sky and the ground, and it's like you don't have an answer, but it's like a great, great question. Wow, yeah, what are we here for? It's like, wow. But, you know, maybe you go to IKEA and say, wow. So the context is important, right? So the Buddha took his son into the woods and sat in this beautiful place in the woods in the grove. And I'll paraphrase kind of grossly what he said, but he said something, it was approximately like this. Is your body, your physical body, is that really who you are? Is that really who you are? So your body. So, you know, people can be very attached to their bodies. You know, my hair is so important. When I was a teenager, my hair was really important. There was, back then, people my age had long hair. I used to sit in class. Instead of learning anything, I sit in class pulling my hair so it would grow faster. Because that was important back then. I had conceit around my hair, how long it was or how short it was. It wouldn't grow from one day to the next, but that'd mean different settings. In some settings, it was really long and cool. I felt good about myself. In other settings, it was too short. And so my conceits are all the stuff in my hair. But, you know, nowadays I don't associate with myself with my hair. You know, the classic thing that I had, teenagers and their zits. I guess most of you wouldn't care if you had a zit on your nose today. It wouldn't be a big deal, but, you know, because you're not going to high school. But if you were going to high school at this age, you know, then it's a bigger deal. Context is everything, right? So the body, so the Buddha said, is the body yourself, the true self, who you really are? And the Buddha's son Rahula said, no, the body is not myself. The body can change. The body, you know. And so then the Buddha said, are the sense impressions that you have, the word is feeling tones, but the sense impressions, that which comes into your senses pick up, the world of yourself, the senses that you have and the experience of you have through the senses, is that yourself? No, the experience I have through my senses is not myself. Even, you know, the internal senses that pick up sensations inside, the smells I have, the tastes I have, the sounds I hear, those are not myself. And then the Buddha said, well, are your perceptions yourself? So if the senses are not yourself, but then what you perceive through your senses, is that yourself? Well, it's obvious that the external world maybe is not yourself, those perceptions. But what about the perceptions you have of yourself? Because the mind makes perceptions about who you are. And so are those perceptions, the mind's capacity to make perceptions, ideas. Have you ever had an erroneous perception of yourself? And thought you were different, you know, than how you actually are? And probably you have. That sometimes has to do with our capacity, our abilities. I can't do that. Or no one's going to like me. I'm that kind of person. And so we have perception, we have an idea. So perception means like an idea, a concept, a singular concept we have about certain things about ourselves. Or so the concepts we have about ourselves, is that who you are? No, the concepts are not that. So if you're not your body, if you're not what you perceive through your senses, sense data, if you're not your concepts that you have, then the Buddha said, well, then are you your thoughts? Or your inner landscape of volition and intentions and thinking and memories and projections of the future, is that who you are? Is that really who you are? And those are pretty fleeting. The Buddha actually said once, he said, if you really want to identify with something as yourself, who you really are, choose your body rather than your thoughts, your mind, because the mind is pretty fleeting. It changes a lot. The body is more stable, so it's a better thing to take as yourself. And if you watch your mind, you know, it changes a lot. Your thoughts change. Are you your thoughts? My wife had to did some hormone therapy when she was in her mid to early 30s that gave her temporary menopause for about 3 months, I think. It was a medical condition she was being treated for. And she would say, these thoughts are not my thoughts. You know, I don't know where these are coming from. This is not how I think. These are not my thoughts. And it's kind of a relief to many times to think that our thoughts are not who we are. You know, who knows where they come from? You know, wow. I don't want to be associated with them too much. So is that inner world of thinking our true self? Because it's so fleeting and changes all the time, the Buddha's son said no. And then the Buddha said, and in some ways I think of this was a guided meditation almost he was giving his son. In this setting, remember this redwood, beautiful grove of trees? And then he's leading him through. And probably each time, you know, your body is not yourself. I can imagine, because I've known people who do this, I've done this. You hear that, something drops away, something gets released. Yes, the body is not the self. I don't have to hold on to that or be so preoccupied with my body. It's not really who I am. Our feelings are not ourselves. Our perceptions, our concepts are not really who we are. And a kind of release, a kind of letting go that happens. And our thoughts are not ourselves. Our volitions, our intentions, motivations are not who we really are. And some kind of release and letting go can happen. And then the final thing the Buddha said is that, is your consciousness yourself? And the Rahula said, no, consciousness is not myself. And something released. And consciousness is something that, especially people who are very mature meditators sometimes get attached to consciousness because it sometimes stands out and highlights in a way that really seems like something special. Consciousness, you know, that's, everything else is impermanent, but consciousness seems stable and that's who I really am. There can be all kinds of philosophies and religious points of view, metaphysics around consciousness and self. But here he said, no, consciousness is not myself. And so then consciousness, something about consciousness, relax, let's go. Some release there as well. And each of these steps of not this, not this, not this, not this, this is not the self, this is not the self, this is not the self. Something releases, something lets go. And as it lets go, what lets go is the clinging, the holding that we have. And we're released into a state of peace or ease or relaxation or happiness that comes when there's no clinging, no tightening, no contraction, no tension in the system at all. No tension, no tightening in the mind. The mind is liberated and free. And so the word that the Buddha used here was anatta. And anatta, atta means self, and an means not. He was saying that these things are not the true self. Don't take this as the self. So that begs the question, well, if those are not the self, what is? And some people say, well, all those things, some people said in the time of the Buddha, all those things are not the self, but you have a self, but that self is invisible. And the Buddha's reply was, if you don't know, if you can't see it, experience it, touch it, if you can't have any control over it or have some agency around it, it has no purpose to call it, you know, the invisible self. You know, it has no role in terms of becoming free of suffering. Because that's the perspective he was looking at, not philosophy, not metaphysics. The Buddha was not a physicist who was looking at the true nature of reality. He was a psychologist who was looking at how human beings can become free of their suffering. And so so he said, all these things are not self, and so don't have the grip of holding on to them. But he wasn't interested to take it to the next step, the logical step. Well, if those are not the self, what is? Because it wasn't necessary for the purposes that he had. The purposes he had was to become free of suffering. His purpose was not to write an essay for a philosophy class. His purpose was not to come up with a grand theory of what the true self is. He did say, don't bother with that question. Don't bother with answering the question, what is the self? Now, you're welcome to do it. Some Buddhist teachers say that any theory about what the self is will cause suffering. I don't know if that's true, but you're welcome to come up with a theory, but that's not what Buddhism is about. Buddhism is not about a theory about what the self is, but rather it's meant to be a pointer, a pointing for you to see with tremendous clarity that you don't have to take or define yourself in some essential way, this is who I really am, and then hold on to it, protect it, defend it, build it up, do all these things that we do with self, all these views and ideas, so we can release and let go. So the Buddha had a not self teaching. Who we are, whatever we are here, the different aspects of our psychophysical being, it's characterized by not having an essential self. It's a process that's constantly in flux and moving and changing, but there's nothing that stays stable. It'd be kind of like the analogy you've probably heard me before say, it's kind of like you go to a river, and the river's constantly flowing, and you take a bucket and fill the bucket with water, and then you walk away from the river and you find some people and say, look, I have the river. You don't have the river anymore. You know, you just have a bucket of water. So as soon as you take you have this river of our psychophysical being of who we are, and if you choose any single thing as this is it, this is who I am, it's like carrying a bucket. And you don't really have yourself anymore. The idea was don't get caught up in these thoughts about self. See that none of this stuff qualifies as some place to grip, to hold on to, get caught up in as self. It doesn't mean you disappear. It doesn't mean you lose your agency. It doesn't mean that you can't take care of yourself. It doesn't mean all those things are still operating. We want you to have a strong sense of capacity and agency in managing in the world, for sure. But that agency and that's done with freedom happens when we don't grab or cling or hold on to the conceit of self or the or the craving of self, or the views of self, any kind of the gripping like that limits us. So the Buddha's teaching, it was a teaching of not self. It was not a teaching of there is no self. So if you hear someone say, the Buddha says, Buddhism teaches there is no self, you're allowed to be perplexed. You know, what? and you can, you know, now you know the Buddha actually didn't say that. What he did say is that there are things that are characterized. You can characterize them by saying these are not self. And so the body's not self, feelings are not self, concepts, perceptions are not self, mental formations and thoughts are not self, consciousness not self. And if you can see that, then you got no problems. Last thing I'll say about this is that, because some of you might still be perplexed, you know, it seems a little bit, still, I said no philosophy, and you know, what's that? Rather than looking at this from the perspective of yourself, look at it from the point of view of what we do to other people. We form attachments, bias, prejudice about other people, that they're that kind of person. And we base it sometimes on their body. You know, all kinds of things. The color of their skin, their age, their disabilities, their gender, their sexual orientation. All kinds of things that we kind of, then we put them, and then there's a grip of clinging around them. Because we, you know, we don't believe in any, you know, whatever you believe about self, psychologically, we kind of have put them into a strong self. Or because of their, you know, their perceptions, their feelings maybe, their thoughts, their beliefs, the stories they have, the intentions they live by, their, you know, I don't know about consciousness. But we'd create a tremendous amount of suffering in the world because of how we see self, or we reify other people as being, this is who they are. So this movement of learning not to see that this is not the self. This is that's not the true person. You know, all these different things allows us, if we don't have to put people and pigeonhole them into this is who they are, then we can see them freely. Let them be free. Let them kind of present themselves as they are, and we can meet them as they are. It's a tremendous gift that we can give to others. So much so that, you know, in Buddhism we say that the point of Buddhism is to get liberated. The ultimate point is liberation, freedom. But it's a mistake to think that you get liberated. You know, me, look, I'm the most liberated. I'm the person most liberated from self on my block. And probably no one at IMC is more liberated from self than I am. They better appreciate it. There's the idea of, that you get liberated, I'm liberated, is probably erroneous. What's probably, or at least not so useful. What's much more useful is when you get liberated, you liberate other people from your prejudice, from your bias, from reifying and making them into something. And then we help other people. If we can liberate other people from us, then it's a better world. Then they can be themselves. And we want everyone to be themselves. We want you to be yourself. But the self that, you know, the self that's there without the clinging and the grasping and the suffering. So I hope that made some sense of that teaching for you. And in case it didn't make any sense or not enough sense or you're still perplexed, you're welcome to leave this teaching here. You don't have to take it with you. And it's not, you know, or you might just file it away, because as you know, as I said earlier, this is really kind of an advanced teaching, not because it's for a lot of studying, but because you want to wait until the right conditions in your mind are there to really see this for yourself. Well, I don't know. Should we stop? Leave you perplexed? Not answer your questions? Yeah? Not answer your questions, leave you? In awe of the redwood trees. So thank you for listening, and thank you for practicing here today. Oh.